If you love true crime and dark stories, then you'll love our other podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.
He told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts.
You know, then this guy gets rich and he has some issues with sexual addiction.
Yeah, and control. Yeah. The Keith Raniere story.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and don't miss a single episode.
In some ways, it starts to make things like Jeffrey Dahmer and that look tame, not in terms of the brutality of what they performed, but in terms of the psychology and manipulation of people.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Available wherever you download podcasts. Robert Christian Hansen was known in the media as the Butcher Baker. In reality, he was an American serial killer. Between 1971 and 1983, Hansen abducted, raped, and murdered at least 17 women in and around Anchorage, Alaska. He hunted many of them down in the wilderness with a Ruger Mini 14 and a knife. This is the story of his chaos, cruelty, and eventual demise of the Baker like no other today.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Hunting humans. Our story of Robert Christian Hansen today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia originally comes from crimelibrary.com. The state motto for Alaska is North to the Future, but if you ask anyone who has ever been there, they'll probably describe it as the last American frontier. Even though it is the biggest state in the country, 2.3 times the size of Texas, population consists of only 634,892 residents, ranking it 47th among all other U.S. territories. Nonetheless, there's no place like it on Earth. The terrain consists of beautiful ocean coasts, rushing rivers, magnificent mountain peaks, famous glaciers, temperate rainforests, and abundance of wildlife. A piece of America that continues to offer residents and visitors alike a pure wilderness experience. The Nick River Valley is a preferred hunting ground for veteran trophy hunters, just 25 miles from the city of Anchorage. The winding gorge, carved by prehistoric glacial ice, makes it a perfect place to find mountain goats, doll sheep, black bears, and moose. On September 12, 1982, John Daly and Audie Holloway, two off-duty Anchorage police officers, spent an afternoon hunting along the Nick River. According to Butcher Baker by Walter Gilmore and Leland E. Hale, the two men had little luck, and as darkness began to fall, they decided to call it a day. The trek was not necessarily easy, but both men were familiar with the area and cut across a wide sandbar. However, as they progressed up the river, they noticed a boot sticking out of the sand. Normally, a find like this would not be cause for concern, but for any police officer, curiosity denotes investigation. Upon closer inspection, the two men were taken aback. Sticking out of the sand was a partially decomposed bone joint. Once their minds registered what they were looking at, both men backed up from the scene. The last thing they wanted to do was disturb or contaminate any evidence. After making note of the location, both men made their way out of the gorge and back up to their camp. Gilmore and Hale wrote that Sergeant Raleigh Port was assigned to cover the investigation. A decorated Vietnam veteran, Port was considered one of the top investigators on the force. He was meticulous with every crime scene and was known to spend hours going over the smallest area. Before disturbing the body, Port had photographs taken of every angle and carefully examined the body itself for trace evidence before having it bagged. Afterwards, he pulled out a large screen and began sifting through the sand around the body. It took several hours for him to finish sifting, but in the end, it paid off. Lying on the screen before him was a single shell casing from a .223 caliber bullet. Port was familiar with this type of ammunition and knew that it was used in high-powered rifles like M16s, Mini AR-14Ss or AR-15S. Back in Anchorage, a preliminary autopsy revealed that the victim was a female of undetermined age and had been dead for approximately 6 months. The cause of death was 3 gunshot wounds from a .223 caliber bullet. Ace bandages were found mingled in with remains, causing investigators to suspect that the victim had been blindfolded at the time of the death. It took a little over 2 weeks to finally identify the body as that of 24-year-old Sherry Morrow, a dancer from the Wild Cherry Bar in downtown Anchorage. She was last seen on November 17, 1981. According to friends, she was going to see a man that had offered her $300 to pose for some pictures. Anchorage police had a sneaking suspicion that Sherry Morrow's murderer was not an isolated incident. Over the last 2 years, there was a sudden increase in the number of missing person reports being filed, many of which were topless dancers and prostitutes. Prior to this latest discovery, the reports had not been prompting much attention. Prostitutes tend to be loners and often travel from city to city only to reappear years later. If there was a link, investigators did not want to tip off the killer. Any concerns they had were kept private. When discussing Morrow's murder with the Anchorage Daily News, investigators said they doubted that it was related to the disappearance of at least 3 other women since 1980. "We don't believe we have a mass murder out there, some psycho knocking off girls," said Anchorage Police Detective Maxine Farrell. Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Lyle Hegesvin was assigned to determine whether or not Sherry Morrow's murder was an isolated incident. Working with the Anchorage Police Department, the two agencies began sharing files and comparing notes. According to Bernard, the close in fair game, the first indication of a possible link appeared to be with 2 unsolved cases from 1980. In the first case, construction workers digging near Euclanta Road discovered the partial remains of a woman buried in a shallow grave. Animals had taken off with the majority of the remains that were there. There's very little evidence left at the scene. The victim had never been identified and was dubbed Euclanta Annie by police assigned to the case. Later that same year, another body was found at a nearby gravel pit. The victim was later identified as Joanne Messina, a local topless dancer. Unfortunately, her body was badly decomposed, and as with Euclanta Annie, there was little evidence to be found. In the end, Huskvin had few leads to follow and very little evidence at his disposal. As months passed, hope of catching the killer began to diminish. Then on the night of June 13, 1983, everything seemed to turn around. Earlier that evening, a trucker was passing through town when he noticed a frantic young female waving her arms and calling out to him. The girl had a pair of handcuffs dangling from one of her wrists, and her clothing was disheveled. She told the trucker that a man was after her and asked him to take her to the Big Timber Motel. Once inside, she had the front desk clerk place a call for her. As she waited outside for her pimp, the truck driver drove straight to the Anchorage Police Department and reported the incident. When Anchorage Police Officer Greg Baker arrived at the Big Timber Motel, he found the girl alone and still in handcuffs. Once he removed her cuffs, she began telling him an extraordinary story. So that's where we begin today on the dark side of Wikipedia. The Robert Christian Hansen story. Not Chris Hansen's story, by the way, but the Robert Christian Hansen story. Probably a reason this never popped up on Dateline or anything like that at the time. A little too similar in names. If you like our show and you want to get all of the exclusive content, the advanced episodes, all commercial free, and our final chapters, then go to patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia or our website darksideofwiki.com and click Become a Darksider. Get all those extras and help keep us on the air. It's Tony and Sean with you on today's episode. So there's a lot of dots to be connected here, and I'm kind of surprised they weren't more urgent on that, or more, I don't know what the word would be, eager, I think, to connect some dots here. It seemed like they were trying to almost dismiss it right off the bat.
When you, the last part that you just referenced, imagine yourself in a position where you're at a truck stop, you're at a rest area, you're at a gas station off the interstate, and somebody comes to you in a frantic state that they're trying to run from a known monster. What do you do? You're on a family vacation on the way to Florida. You literally stopped to get some Subway. I mean, do you help them? What do you do?
I think he did the right thing. I mean, he just like, okay, I'm going to drop you off here and then I'm going to get my ass over to the police station so I'm not the prime suspect in whatever the fuck is going on here.
I'm going to not touch you so there's no DNA. I'm going to call 911 while you haven't. And then I'm going to wait for the police to arrive and I'm going to go on my merry way.
I think the scary prospect, though, I mean, at that point in time or today as well, is you have no idea what the hell you're getting into. When that's
a scam artist, yeah. They could be scamming you, yeah. Which is very sad because God forbid somebody is truly in that position that other people have scammed you in the past, where you then have to be skeptical of, okay, are you literally running for your life? Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah. It's one of those things where what do you do? You want to be the good Samaritan, you want to be the helpful person, but sometimes it just turns out that you're going to be the victim right there yourself, and you gotta I don't know. I mean, I think instinctually most of us would do the right thing and try and help them, but you still got to be extremely cautious because it could go bad very quick.
We all too often talk about these monsters, these serial killers. They can find love. They can find a wife. This guy married twice. Mm-hmm. Two people have said I do to him. Two. You know how many people, good humans out there trying to find one wife? This whack job, two women said I do.
And that's what's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
that someone like that can attract another human being to them that many times.
Two children.
Yep.
Imagine how many couples out there that are trying so hard to make a baby.
Yeah.
Two kids he fathered.
It's
17 to 21 victims.
I know. Let's continue into the story. According to reports she gave to investigators, she had been approached on the streets by a 40-ish red-haired man and offered $200 for oral sex. She agreed to the price, but midway through the act, the man locked a handcuff around her wrist and pulled out a gun. He told her if she cooperated, he would not kill her. He then drove to his house in Moldon, an upper-class area not far from town, and once inside, the man brutally raped her, bit her nipples, and at one point shoved a hammer into her vagina. After a brief rest, the man said that he was going to fly her to his cabin in the mountains and told her he would let her go if she cooperated. Upon their arrival at the airport, her kidnapper shoved her inside a small plane and began loading supplies. The young prostitute knew she was in serious trouble and that the man would probably kill her once they got to his cabin. Waiting until his back was turned, she shoved open the door and ran for her life. According to her, he chased after her at first, but then relented when he saw her wave down the truck driver. After making a formal statement at police headquarters, investigators drove the young prostitute to Merrill Field, the airport where she had been taken. They were hoping she could identify her abductor's plane. As they drove through the small airport, she spotted a blue and white Piper Supper Cub, tail number N3089Z, and identified the plane. A check with the flight tower revealed that the plane belonged to Robert C. Hansen, who lived on Old Harbor Road. Gilmore and Hale wrote that after dropping the woman off at the hospital, Baker and a group of fellow officers went directly to Hansen's house. Hansen became outraged when confronted with the young woman's charges. He claimed to have never met the girl and stated that she was probably trying to shake him down for money. To him, the entire story was absurd. "You can't rape a prostitute, can you?" he said. Hansen went on to state that his wife and two young children were vacationing in Europe and said that he had spent the entire evening with two friends. His alibi checked out and no formal charges were filed. Just as things seemed to be calming down again, investigators were called to the scene of another grisly discovery. According to reports in the Anchorage Daily News on September 2nd, 1983, just 10 days shy of the one-year anniversary of discovering Sherry Murrow, another body was found along Nick River. The remains were partially decomposed and buried in a shallow grave. The victim was later identified as 17-year-old Paula Golding, was a topless dancer and prostitute from Anchorage. She'd gone missing some 5 months earlier. An autopsy revealed that she had been shot with a .223 caliber bullet. Investigators are now convinced they had a serial killer on their hands and contacted the FBI for assistance. This is not the first time Alaska authorities had dealt with a serial killer, but their last attempt was not successful. Between 1979 and 81, serial killer Thomas Richard Bundy murdered at least five Fairbanks area women. When police finally discovered who their killer was, he was already on the run. Just 1 hour after his arrest warrant was issued, he committed suicide by plowing his motorcycle head on into a truck. The FBI was known for its dogged determination in serial murder investigations, and everyone seemed to agree on asking for their assistance. In response to Anchorage's request for help, the FBI's investigative support unit sent Special Agent Don Douglas, a legendary figure in law enforcement, to help profile Alaska's latest serial killer. Many local investigators felt that Robert Hansen was still a viable suspect and were anxious to share their suspicions with Douglas. In his 1996 book, Mindhunter, inside the FBI's elite serial crime unit, John Douglas describes his initial profile of Alaska's suspected serial murderer. According to Douglas, the perpetrator specifically chose prostitutes and topless dancers because a majority were transients and usually went unnoticed. Upon the urging of local investigators, Douglas began looking into Robert Hansen's background. He took note of the fact that Hansen was of small stature, heavily pockmarked, and suffered from a severe speech impediment. Due to Hansen's unsightly looks, Douglas surmised that he suffered from severe skin problems as an adolescent and was probably teased by his peers. In turn, he would have low self-esteem, which would have prompted him to live in isolated areas. Douglas considered the abuse of prostitutes a way for perpetrators to get back at women. If Hansen was the killer, he was probably using them as a way to get his revenge. Several investigators were familiar with Hansen and said that he was known around the area as a proficient hunter. He earned his reputation after taking down a wild doll sheep with a crossbow bow. Perhaps Douglas surmised Robert Hansen tired of elk, bear, and doll sheep and had instead turned his attention to more interesting prey. As the profile progressed, Douglas told investigators that if Hansen was the killer, he was probably a saver and would be keeping small souvenirs from his victims. The only way to rule Hansen out as a suspect would be for investigators to find a hole in his alibi. Douglas suspected that his friends were lying for him and encouraged investigators to threaten them with charges if they were found to be lying. State Police Sergeant Glenn Forth decided to bring the men in for questioning. As it turns out, the strategy worked and both men confessed that they had not been with Robert Hansen on the night the young prostitute was abducted and brought to the airport. Investigators also learned from Hansen's friends that he was committing insurance fraud. Apparently, a burglary he reported to police in which several items were stolen from his home never occurred, and Hansen was hiding the items in his basement. After learning of Hansen's deceit, both went before Judge Victor Carlson with a 48-page affidavit and secured 8 search warrants to be executed against Robert Hansen and his property. So there you go. It's one of those things, again, you are murdering people. You probably shouldn't be fucking with other things that are going to get you in trouble.
Well, I got away with killing 17 people. I may as well fake some things stolen. Let me pop these laptops in the basement and report that they've been stolen to get $2,100. Really?
Yeah.
Because if a detective shows up and you don't take care of the murder that well, you're going down for more than tax fraud or lying about a stolen dude, you got a Dell.
Yeah.
Again, though, I think it is the psychology. It is the mental, well, I got away with this. I may as well do this. I got away with this. I may as well steal a couple lottery tickets at the come and go. Got away with this. And then you ultimately get arrested. And then, oh, well, then. We got you on this very, very small felony, but we started to look at you, dug a little deeper, and now you're going to jail for life. You're a dumbass.
It's it's kind of amazing what will end up taking down someone who does horrible, horrible things, where it's not necessarily the horrible, horrible thing that takes you down. It's, oh, you're doing this. You hide it. You hid some items in your upstairs from insurance adjusters. And oh, and by the way, oh, it turns out you're killing people, too. It's something that seems to happen time and time again with these fine folks. Let's continue into the story and learn more about exactly what they start to discover as they get those warrants on Robert Christian Hansen. On October 27, 1983, investigators followed Hansen to work and asked him to come with them to the police station for questioning. Hansen never bothered to ask why they wanted to talk to him and agreed to go along. Simultaneously, two groups of investigators served warrants on Hansen's house and plane. According to the book Hunting Humans by Michael Newton, investigators found weapons throughout the house, but nothing to implicate Hansen in any of the murders. Then, just as they were about to call it a day, one of the officers discovered a hidden space tucked in the attic rafters. Within it, they discovered a Remington 552 rifle, a Thompson Contender 7mm single-shot pistol, an aviation map with specific locations marked off, various pieces of jewelry, newspaper clippings, a Winchester 12-gauge shotgun, a driver's license, various ID cards, some of which belonged to the dead woman. As incriminating as these items were, the most important piece of evidence was found last. A .223 caliber mini 14 rifle. Robert Christian Hansen was born on February 15, 1939 in Ertzville, Iowa, to Christian Hansen, a Danish immigrant, baker, and his wife Edna. De Close wrote that Hansen had a difficult upbringing. His father was very strict and insisted that his son work long hours in the family's bakery. Adding to this ever-present strain, he was always considered small for his age, and his face bore severe acne sores all through his adolescence. In later years, he would recall his face as one big pimple. Although he was naturally left-handed, his parents forced him to use his right hand. In later years, he would claim that the resulting stress made his slight stuttering problem even worse. He had very few friends in school, and those he did have never got close to him. In 1957, Hansen graduated high school and shortly thereafter enlisted in the Army Reserves. Following basic training, he was required to devote one weekend a month to the military. He spent the rest of his time working in his father's bakery and sometimes volunteering as a Pocahontas Junior Police drill instructor. During 1960, he fell in love with married a local girl. His first major event in Robert Hansen's life occurred December 7, 1960. As retribution for perceived abuses by the people of Pocahontas, Iowa, he burned down the school bus garage. Unfortunately for Hansen, a friend turned him in and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. His wife was ashamed of her husband's action and immediately filed for divorce. After serving only 20 months, Hansen was paroled despite being assessed as having an infantile personality. Shortly after his release, he met a young woman. The two hit it off and were wed the fall of 1963. For the next few years, Hansen bounced from job to job and was arrested several times for petty thefts. In 1967, he decided it was time for a new start and left for Alaska. Anchorage appeared to be the perfect getaway for Robert Hansen. Gilmore and Hale wrote that he was treated well by the residents and soon earned a reputation as a great outdoorsman and hunter. He would stalk doll, sheep, wolves, and bear with a rifle or bow and arrow. In 1969, 70, and 71, he had four animals entered into Pope and Young's trophy hunting world record books. Hansen's den was soon loaded with animal mounts. Nonetheless, all his good fortune was short-lived. In 1977, he was arrested for stealing a chainsaw and sentenced to 5 years in prison. After a customary mental evaluation, a prison psychiatrist concluded that Hansen suffered from bipolar affective disorder and requested that the courts order him to take lithium to control his mood swings. Regardless, the order was never enforced, and Hansen was released after serving just 1 year. During the early 1980s, Hansen reported a burglary to his home, which in the end netted him $13,000 from the insurance company. Shortly after receiving a settlement, Hansen opened his own bakery at the corner of 9th and Ingram. By this time, Hansen and his wife had two children, and his problems with law were all but forgotten. His business prospered, and he was considered a successful and respected member of the community. Back at State Police headquarters, Hansen denied any involvement in the murders. After a brief game of cat and mouse, he grew tired of the allegations and requested an attorney. Hansen was then placed under arrest and charged with assault, kidnappings, weapons offenses, theft, and insurance fraud. So eventually the charges come falling down on the butcher baker, who really seemed to, for not having the brightest of IQs, somewhat kind of got his life together, at least on the outside.
Yeah, he seems to be almost a scholar of sorts, trying to clean up his life and becoming a productive member of society.
But does he become a productive member of society? And that's like the question is, once you have done so many things like that and you've become such a pariah, I guess, internally, how do you just turn that off and become the guy who's handing out, you know, glazed donuts to the children and the people who are hungry in the morning, you know, loading up for their workplaces? How do you become the nice guy that people start respecting?
Well, you just hope that you meet a group of people that don't know you about your past.
I guess that's true. But internally, how do you turn that off?
You never do. And eventually it builds to the point where you get caught for stealing or something, which sure. then spurs all of your past. But I'd like to think that when you have the ability to do something so horrific and still be able to function on a daily life without going insane, you probably have the ability to turn off your murdering ways and become a productive member of society. Normal humans who have never done something so heinous, things on a far lower level of severity will make you go a little kooky. Whereas those that push the limits of your brain to do such, oh my gosh, ghastly things, in comparison, it'd probably be rather easy to, you know what, I'm gonna put that knife away. I'm gonna stop killing prostitutes. I might get a good job at CVS in the pharmacy. wear my smock, put my name tag on. I'm gonna go get myself a new pair of shoes at the DSW shoe warehouse, and I'm gonna name myself Calvin. I'm gonna put Calvin Johnson on my application, kind of like that in the Back to the Future where he wanted to become the mayor, and he worked at the diner. He became the mayor. Yeah. Well, guess what? I may have killed 17 to 21 victims, but today I'm going to go work at the Walgreens.
Yeah.
So
I guess
as screwed up as it sounds, you know, rather quite easy, but it all more often than not, it always catches up with you.
Yeah, it's I completely agree. It's one of those things where you just don't know how someone can do something like that. But to some, I think it's an easier switch to turn than it is for others.
And as we get to know more about this guy and where he was ultimately locked up, if you Google the correctional center where he stayed, this looks like a resort. It's right next to a mountain. It's in Alaska. This is, short of the barbed wire fencing, seems to be a nice Airbnb.
It's, so you're looking at the place right now?
The Spring Creek Correctional Center.
Okay. And describe to us what you're seeing.
Well, on the right, you'll see a nice mountain. That's Mount Juno, snow-capped, 12 months of the year. What then appears to your left, an air traffic control tower. Well, clearly it's a security tower to make sure if you try to escape, we'll shoot you. Now, pay no attention to the barbed wire fencing. On the right is the communal cafe, where you will be served mashed potatoes with an ice cream scooper, probably tased if you give the guard a bad look or two. And in 2004, which will be years after your death, another inmate will kill his cellmate and be sentenced to an additional 30 years in prison.
Goes downhill from there.
His name, Carl Abul.
Yeah.
Aside from that, man, it's a Best Western plus. No, in all sincerity, it looks like a small airport hangar with a couple. I guess when I think of correctional centers and I see it, I think I do not want to go there. That is not good. Which again, I guess Alaska comparatively, anything looks pretty resort-like in Alaska.
Sure.
In any event, real good guy, this Butcher Baker.
Let's continue on to his story. We'll jump into the wild, crazy world of 1983 and see exactly where he takes his fate. On November 3rd, 1983, an Anchorage grand jury returned four indictments against Hansen: first-degree assault and kidnapping, 5 counts of misconduct in possession of a handgun, theft in the second degree, and theft by deception and insurance fraud. Investigators were still awaiting the ballistics test results on Hansen's rifle, so the state decided to hold off on charging him with murder. Hansen pled not guilty to all charges. Bail was set at $500,000. Newton wrote that the ballistics test results finally came in on November 20, 1983. The FBI crime lab in Washington, D.C. determined that the shell casings found at the gravesites had all been fired from Hansen's rifle. The firing pin and the extractor markers were identical. Given the mass of evidence building against him, Hansen realized that the chances of him winning in court were slim. So on February 22, 1984, Hansen had his defense attorney, Fred Dewey, arrange a meeting with Anchorage D.A. Victor Crum. During the meeting, Crum offered Hansen a deal. In exchange for a full confession, the DA guaranteed him that he would only be charged with 4 cases that they knew of, and he'd be able to serve his time in federal facilities rather than a maximum security institution. Hansen reluctantly agreed to the conditions. After both sides had signed off on the agreement, Hansen began describing one of his typical abductions. The following transcript, which has been edited for space, was originally published in the Gilmore and Hale book. I pull out the gun. I think the standard speech was, look, you're a professional. You don't get excited. You know there's some risk to what you've been doing. If you do exactly what I tell you, you're not going to get hurt. You're just going to count this off as a bad experience and be a little more careful next time. Who are you going to proposition or go out with? You know, I tried to act as though I could to get them as scared as possible. Give that right away, even before I started talking at all. Reach over, you know, and hold that head back and put a gun in her face and get him to feel helpless, scared right there. I'm sure maybe it's not the same procedure for you. You always try to get control of the situation so some things don't start going bad. Maybe I've seen some cop shows on TV. I don't know, okay? Whenever Hansen got a victim under his control, he'd normally take her to his plane and fly them out to his remote cabin. According to Newton, he would brutally rape and torture the women. Afterwards, he'd strip them naked, sometimes going so far as blindfolding them, and set them free in the woods. Hansen would give the victim a brief head start and then hunt them down with a hunting knife or high-powered rifle. In describing his hunts to investigators, Hansen said that he was like going after a trophy doll sheep or a grizzly bear. When investigators first heard Hansen's confession, they couldn't help but think of the popular fictional story The Most Dangerous Game by writer Richard Connell. Stories about a shipwrecked trio that find themselves stranded on an uncharted island where they meet a Russian count known only as General Zarov. The group is initially delighted to find someone else on the island, but their happiness turns to sorrow when they realize that the shipwreck was no accident and the good general had lured them there so he could hunt them down. Up until the early 1980s, Richard Connell's story was a work of fiction, the product of one man's imagination. Robert Hansen was conducting a real-life version of The Most Dangerous Games. I'm also thinking of, what was the other one? The Hunger Games, kind of? Wasn't that one where they would do that sort of thing?
Yes.
This guy...
But I don't think Jennifer Hudson was a part of this.
not in this edition of the program?
No.
No, it's... It is a shocking thing.
Jennifer Lawrence, excuse me.
Okay. Was that who was in it? Yeah, Hudson was in, I can't think of the movie. It was a music one, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's coming to me, but it's not on the top of my head. His story continues. In fact, we will actually get into the area of his death because he finally does kick it and discuss a little bit more about the insanity that was the life of Robert Christian Hansen in our final chapter. If you'd like to hear that and be part of it, become a final chapter, or to get the final chapter, become a Dark Sider. Sign up to do that over on our website, darksideofwiki.com, or go to patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia and get access to the final chapter of this and all of our episodes, advanced episodes, all commercial free, and help keep us on the air. And we will see you in the final chapter of Robert Christian Hansen here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.